Before we get to the Cohen, I wanted to just talk about a couple of other things. The first is when I was driving in today, I noticed that, I'm not sure this is right, but at least some of the flags were at half mast, but maybe not all of them were. And so someplace in my head I thought, oh, maybe it's not, maybe it's for Nelson Mandela, but it's not official, you know, and so just some places are doing it. But at any rate, I wanted to just acknowledge that. And there's something in the book by Peter Hirschhoff that Joan likes a lot, where Hirschhoff says, it's not enough to know what Buddha nature is, you have to know what Buddha nature does. And maybe that has something to do with some of the things that he did, and his generosity and forbearance and warmth. The other thing that is going on today is it's Rohatsu, which so it's the within Japanese Buddhism and Japanese Zen, it's the day in which we acknowledge the enlightenment of the historical Buddha. And in relation to what I want to talk about today, I want to stress that on the one hand, part of that story is the ordinariness of it and the rejecting of rejection, the giving up, the notion of giving up things. So as you all know, it's his awakening comes very soon after he almost dies from committing himself to incredibly harsh austerities and trying really to starve the body down, and that he's revived by a Sujata who comes and brings him this bowl of incredibly exponentially mathematically enriched milk. So from, you know, the milk of 100 cows boiled down to make the milk of 50, to, you know, concentrated into 50, into 25, and so on. And so there's something really luscious and not a moment of renunciation at all involved in that. And so in some sense, it's the extraordinariness of the ordinary and the everyday and just the way our lives are. And in a similar vein, as you all know, one of the things he says is everything is enlightened already, it just doesn't realize it yet. So there isn't any sense of going somewhere else or making some really big change, but just recognizing what's already true. On the other hand, there are a couple of aspects of the story, I think, that suggest that this very little change is nevertheless a big change in some way. So as you know, he when he gets up, having been revived by the wonderful milk, he says that he will sit under the Bodhi tree until he's awakened. And then he also goes to this river that he's sitting near and makes a vow and says, if this, I'm going to toss this bowl of mine onto the river, and if it floats upstream, then I will be enlightened this very night. And of course it does float upstream. So there's something that reverses the ordinary course of things, just going about their normal business that's involved in our practice as well. And then, as we mentioned last week, one of the first things he says that morning also is he asks himself, are you afraid of this happiness? So the sense that there's both a very slight change that's almost just a recognition of what's already true, but that in some way it marks a turn or a turning about is, I think both those things are at work in the ordinary mind cone. So I want to read that and then just try to talk about one other part of it for a few minutes today. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about one of the practice points there. So Zhaozhou asked Nanchuan, what is the way? Nanchuan said, ordinary mind is the way. Should I try to turn toward it? If you try to turn toward it, you move away from it. How can I know the way if I don't turn toward it? The way has nothing to do with knowing or not knowing. Thinking you know is delusion. Thinking you don't know is blankness. When you truly reach the way, it's as vast as space itself. How could we talk about this in terms of it's this or it isn't this? With these words, Zhaozhou suddenly understood. The last time we visited this, we looked at the phrase, if you try to turn toward it, you move away from it. And one of the things we emphasized there, and I want to make a similar point or get around to something similar in terms of another portion of the koan, is that it's really important to take that up, if you do so, as a practice and not as a prescription or proscription, really, a prohibition for how to live your life. You're never being told never to turn toward anything. you're never being told that that's the way to live any more than the kind of harsh austerities or renunciations of the Buddha's earlier practice are at the heart of our way. But what you're being told, I think, is that if you sit with, if you try to turn toward it, you move away from it, in addition to all that reaching, which we always do, you may find some places and some moments where there's something before that, where everything is here, there's no need, there's no impulse to turn towards something. And then, of course, in the next moment, you're going to turn towards something. So that's fine as well. And I want to say a kind of similar thing about the other part of the koan as a practice. It seems to me that if you try to turn toward it, you move away from it. It's in a way focusing on the sort of very ordinary and everyday aspect, in, at least in one respect, of our practice and of awakening. Whereas the next portion that I want to look at maybe talks about the way in which, or points toward the way in which it is a kind of turning about or revolution. So when you truly, the way has nothing to do with knowing or not knowing. Thinking you know is delusion, thinking you don't know is blankness. When you truly reach the way, it's as vast as space itself. How could we talk about this in terms of it's this or it isn't this? So one thing we talked about when we took this koan up a few weeks ago as a koan seminar was this notion of not having anything to do with knowing or not knowing. And we followed a point that Joan had made in one of her talks where she distinguishes between this not knowing that's not a good thing and the other koan that is always on our lips about not knowing is most intimate. And Joan makes the point that here the not knowing is associated with blankness. And I think it's in a way a sort of willful refusal to engage things. You know, if I can't know it, then I'll take my ball and go home and I simply won't know it. Whereas not knowing is most intimate is a kind of openness and exploratory quality. So I think that's true. And in that sense, you know, this koan emphasizes something a little bit different from what we ordinarily focus on. I think the other thing that's important, though, is that the koan is not simply reminding us that as against this blankness, there's a sort of intimate engagement, which is another form of not knowing. But it's also talking about the peculiarity of trying to know the way. And we talked about this a little bit at the koan seminar a few weeks ago. I think in some sense, and not knowing is most intimate, reminds us of that. Everything is finally unknowable, partly because it's empty and interconnected and so on. But there's a peculiar kind of wall that we hit, though that's probably the wrong metaphor, in terms of the not knowing that's involved here. When you truly reach the way, it's as vast as space itself. How could we talk about this in terms of it's this or it isn't this? And I think the implication here is that we can never step outside of the way, and we already know that for sure because we know the way is not only the teaching but the way things are and the great movement of the Tao and the unfolding of the universe and so on. But to really think that there's therefore no way to stand outside it can be fairly unnerving. I think everything we know in some way mentally we stand over against. You know, we put it at some distance. We're able to, at least intellectually, though we know in some way this is not true for anything that we can know, but we're able to sort of set boundaries to it. You know, this is where the chair starts, this is where it stops, these are the properties that it has, this is what it's good for, and so on. So there's a way in which we can sort of bound that and set it over against us and know it as an object. I think self-knowledge is very much a similar kind of thing, usually where one part of ourselves distances another part and looks at it as if from the outside. And so the claim here, I think, is that when it comes to the way, you can't do that. And so as soon as you do that, and of course if you sit with it, you'll do it again and again and again, that you've already missed it. So just in the way the koan earlier says, if you try to turn toward it, you move away from it. In a similar way, as soon as you say, I'm going to set it outside me, and here's what it is, or here's what it's not, or I don't want to predicate anything about it yet, but at least I'm going to set it over against me, and if I sit with it long enough, I'll really figure the fucker out, you know, I'll know what it is, that's already a mistake. So I want to read, I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago when we talked about this first, I want to read two short passages from the American pragmatist William James and one from a Western philosopher of Buddhism, Dale Wright, whose work Joan likes a lot. So the James, the first thing is from an essay called The Meaning of Truth. And he focuses really on this this strange thing about not being able to step outside of it. And here he's talking about, not exactly the way, but he's talking about our experience and whether it's possible to step outside of our experience as such. And I think it's a related problem. And he's following up, I won't read this, but he's following up on a passage where he says, well, if we want to check the veracity of something, we have to check it against something outside itself. So you can't tell if what the newspaper says is true by simply rereading the newspaper. You better check it against some other sources to begin to evaluate that particular experience. So we're always stepping, as I said before, we're stepping outside of one thing in order to compare it to something else and get a handle on it. And there's when the field is sufficiently large, that simply isn't possible. So there's some kind of unnerving and wonderful things here. You generalize this, that's stepping outside of any particular thing and judging it by something else, by saying that any opinion, however satisfactory, can count positively and absolutely as true only so far as it agrees with a standard beyond itself. And if you then forget that this standard perpetually grows up endogenously inside the web of the experiences, you may carelessly go on to say that what distributively holds true of each experience holds also collectively of all experience, and that experience as such and in its totality owes whatever truth it may be possessed of to its correspondence with absolute realities outside of its own being. I hope you can hear the resonance with the idea of somehow standing outside the way and trying to judge it from the outside. This evidently is the popular and traditional position. From the fact that finite experiences must draw support from one another, philosophers pass to the notion that experience overall must need an absolute support. He means philosophers that he's disagreeing with and trying to refute. The denial of such a notion by humanism lies probably at the root of most of the dislike which it incurs. So that claim that you cannot get outside of experience overall. And then a shorter passage from a series of lectures, Pragmatism. For pluralistic pragmatism, truth grows up inside of all finite experiences. They lean on each other, but the whole of them, if such a whole there be, leans on nothing. All homes are in finite experience. Finite experience as such is homeless. Nothing outside the flux secures the issue of it. So if you're working on, you know, the way, what is the way, you cannot step outside of it to see it from the outside and encapsulate it or characterize it in some way. So there's something peculiar about that. Dale Wright, who's a wonderful professor of religion and philosophy, makes some similar points in terms of, in relation to a discussion of the early Chinese Chang teacher, Wang Bo. And I want to read just a couple passages there and then just say a few more things and then I'll be done. A significant proportion of Wang Bo's Dharma talk is concerned with correcting the conception of that which is experienced in enlightenment. This is the conception of mind or Buddha, this is what Wang Bo is trying to speak against, still conceived dualistically as something to which the practitioner must come to be related. And I hope you can hear the connection between that and the ordinary mind koan and the part we're taking up. Turning away from ordinary things in the world, the source is sought, and again he's saying, Wang Bo is saying that this is not the right way to do it. Turning away from ordinary things in this world, the source is sought as something extraordinary, but still something, one being among the many, even if more mysterious, more powerful, and so on. Taking one rhetorical pose after another, the Wang Bo text asserts that the source is not anything at all, but rather that within which all things are encountered. The ground is encountered not in a separate relation, but in the midst of all other relations. Thus the practitioner is not to establish an independent relation to the ground in addition to and distinct from all other relations. Instead, practice is to cultivate the understanding and the awareness that every relation to things in the world is simultaneously a relation to the ground of all things, which has no existence independent of the worldly things through which it is manifest. This ungraspability of mind, Buddha, or emptiness is a constant theme of Wang Bo's sermons. And here's a quotation from Wang Bo. You may say that it is near, yet if you follow it from world to world, you will never catch it in your hands. Then you may describe it as far away, and lo, you will see it just before your eyes. Follow it, and behold, it escapes you. Run from it, and it follows you close. You can neither possess it nor have done with it. I had a work in the room with somebody a few weeks ago when the person was talking about things kind of opening up and said, oh, but I can't, there's something here that I can't quite grasp. And I just said, yeah, that's right. You can't grasp it. Because it is only experienced within other experiences, a subtle form of awareness is cultivated to make possible a manifestation of this source, one which doesn't turn away from things completely, but at the same time is not compelled by things and thus obstructed. As the mind shifts in succession from one situation and object of awareness to another, the enlightened mind stays attuned to the one mind at the root of all things. Conceived in terms of the concept of emptiness, we are led to understand that all forms, all appearances, make their appearance in and through emptiness, yet conversely, emptiness appears only in and through appearances. And then just one more really short passage. The process of Zen practice is thought to lead not to definitive knowledge or grounding in certainty, but rather to an openness better characterized by letting go. Therefore, the literature of Wangbo does not propose a conception of the true self, nor does it conclude in an account of the way things really are. Instead, it suggests practices of thought and images of masters who let go of thought even while thinking. So, the pertinence, I think, is that if we sit with, you know, it's as vast as space itself and the way has nothing to do with knowing or not knowing, I think we'll spend a lot of our time, and Lorraine had an experience like this during the Cohen seminar, just feeling in a way that it's driving us mad. You know, what would it mean to think about something that we neither know nor don't know and that we can't make an object of knowledge? And I think in a way that's somewhat similar to if you try to turn toward it, you turn away from it. If you really take up this part of the koan, the part of, you know, the way has nothing to do with knowing or not knowing, you'll find yourself, you know, trying to figure out what that means or trying to somehow stand outside the way in order to get a feel for what it is. There will probably be moments, though, where that effort falls away and then something else really happens. I think one of the things to say is that, but before I say this, what I would suggest and what I would recommend if you take this up is that you really just carry it around and not worry too much if you understand it. You know, I mean, there'll be moments where you say, well, it's the way has nothing to do with knowing or not knowing. Well, then how can I understand? How can I know what it is if it's not knowing or not knowing? If it's neither knowing nor not knowing. But if you just sit with it, if you just walk around with it, one of the things that might happen if you just say it to yourself is you notice that things start feeling a little bit different. If you sat in a retreat, for example, and walked around with it for a day, what does the world feel like when you say to yourself, the way has nothing to do with knowing or not knowing? What do you feel like in those moments? How do you feel in terms of your relation to this big space that you're sitting in? So in all kinds of unexpected ways, things will shift. And I think one of the important things to think about is just this thing about, how's the feeling different? What's different about the feeling tone? What begins to shift as I do that? The other thing I would say, and this is in a way to kind of let part of a cat out of part of a bag, but I think, you know, teachers always say about koans in general, you know, you think you're working on it, but it's working on you. In that moment of the way has nothing to do with knowing or not knowing, you may begin to feel the space work on you, and you may begin to feel yourself relax into the space. And I think there's finally less of a sense of grasping something than of being held by something. And it won't be something that you can stand over against and look at and say, here's what it is. But there may be a feeling of, you know, as the Dale Wright says, of really allowing yourself to be held by this, allowing yourself to fall into it, and allowing yourself to open to it. I mentioned to one person a couple weeks ago an odd image, and this is, I guess, where I'll close, an odd image that came to me some time ago while sitting. There's a thing in dog training, and none of my dogs ever got this far, though it would be great if they did, but when the dog is really pretty far along, you can do a thing apparently where the dog stands for examination. And what that means is you take the dog to a dog training class, and the dog, not for you, whom the dog already knows well and really trusts, but the dog will stand there and let the teacher or something like that examine him. Okay. And for me, the ordinary mind cone is very much a feeling like that. That the moment when things open up, it's as if I'll stand for examination. Do you know what I mean? The universe can touch me. The universe can put its hands on me. I'm not terrified of it. And there's something holding me there and allowing me to do that. And I think that's where I want to stop for today. Oh, let me say one more thing. We talked during the Cohen seminar, and I think the last time we talked about this, about given the fact that way has various meanings, and so the way partly means how we practice and the teaching, but it's also the way things are or the Tao, that in a way that's pretty explicit here and is implicit with most Koans, there's a kind of practice aspect, but then there's also kind of a deep Dharma point. And so the way has nothing to do with knowing or not knowing. On the one hand, would tell us something about how to sit, how to go about practicing, and how not to grasp after things on a certain level. And at the same time, the relation that sets up is also the Dharma point. That the moment where there's nothing to know or not know, it's a different kind of thing going on, is also the way in some fundamental sense. So I'll probably give one more talk on this where we just go back to ordinary mind is the way and try to talk about that another time. So I would welcome any questions or comments or violent disagreements. Thank you.
I think for me, an important moment in my practice came when I realized that that I didn't have to let something that I was interacting with in my environment, either visually or by touch, or you know, however my senses picked it up. I didn't have to let my brain lump it or split it or create something else, like sitting on my cushion and hearing a plane, and instead of just hearing the sound, you know, I've already got in my mind, oh, that's a plane, and that plane is full of people, and it's going somewhere. You know, it's just like, oh, I don't have to actually do that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I can just that, you know, there's just a sound.
Yeah.
It's just a sound that I hear.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to me, that's not knowing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it feels, you know, and it's hard for me to attain that. And, you know, that space is fleeting for me. But when I feel it, it's really freeing.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. I've been sitting with the Cohen the last couple of weeks, kind of just because it seemed like a nice thing to do, and walking around with it. And I became aware just how much I do, and I'm sure we all do, that I'm constantly, you know, kind of triaging experience and wondering, you know, do I have to worry about it? Is it okay? Do I like it? But then also just you know, categorizing it all the time. And there's this incredible, you know, the brain is fabulous, you know, I mean, its ability to do that and the kind of categories it can make are just stupendously wonderful and stuff, you know, so it'd be terrible to sort of think that you were never supposed to do that. But as I sort of said, oh, the way has nothing to do with knowing or not knowing, that the kind of thing you're talking about started happening more and more often. And when I've sat within in a retreat, something like that happens as well. And if you stay with it anyway, like if you took it up in a retreat, one of the interesting things I think is when that's true and you're having more experiences like that, how do things start to feel and how do they start to shift? You know, I think one of the things that happens is I notice that I feel different when I'm doing that, that something really softens in a way, and the things around me start to feel different also. And then in some way also the possibility of staying with that experience long enough so that I kind of get to the bottom of it, which isn't quite right, but I mean, it's like, oh, that's one of the ways that I'm in the world in this, and that's one of the ways the world is, you know, this moment of not categorizing, sort of settling into something else. That's the way in some way. I mean, there, it's holding you, you know? So, yeah, thank you.
Well, I was just with that part about the, you know, thinking you know is delusion, thinking you don't know is blankness, in terms of like that blankness of, you know, when there's a teenager, you know, more prototypical, says, oh, I don't know. It's like, he doesn't want to engage. But, you know, that part of myself that at different times, you know, there's a continuum. But, you know, times where I felt like I didn't have the capacity to deal with whatever. So I was really, you know, shutting down emotionally in my life. And it's like, where's that, you know, that range of, there's real extreme where you could label that. You know, you're just not overwhelmed. Versus, you know, where's that, just, you know, being on autopilot, going through the day kind of thing, or to another kind of shutting down.
Yeah.
Instead of being willing to be awake and alive to the moment.
Yeah, that's great. And I think, I mean, a retreat's a really good time to do it, though. I mean, I think it's important that it's really unlikely that a tiger's going to eat you in the next 3 minutes. Do you know what I mean? that you really can afford to try to be comfortable with, oh, on some level, I don't know. And I don't have to stop engaging. I can sort of move out into that with a certain kind of open heart and see what happens. And I think, you know, this I've been saying this a lot lately, but I think Joan's thing about sort of the multiple rooms is so important, you know, because I think pretty clearly most of us are going to spend a majority of our time not interacting with things that way. You know, that there are lots of real reasons why in particular situations we can't do it. It would be a bad idea, you know, not to figure out whether it's a tiger or a boat or something like that. And also just sort of by way of habit and training, we don't do it. But if there are significant moments and time stretches where we're not doing that, I think it really shifts our relation to doing that. And that's such an important part of practice when you sort of come back out into everyday life or whatever that might be, or a place where a lot of demands are placed on you. The wager of practice would be that having had those other experiences, maybe quickly, maybe gradually, maybe, you know, probably never entirely, but to some significant degree, changes your own relation to that more defended mode. You know, so you hold it more lightly, you're less sure that it's giving you everything that you need, and you're probably less committed to the particular interpretations that you're making in the given situation and moment. So I guess we're out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.